And we have a court ruling on the car tabs from a King County Superior Court judge, and Hannah Scott is here with those details. And it sounds like generally the judge believes that the initiative to impose $30 car tabs is constitutional.
Yeah, it came as a surprise to quite a few people. In his written order, King County Superior Court Judge Marshall Ferguson rejected most of the arguments that I-976 was unconstitutional. That includes more than a dozen claims, some that it contained too many subjects, that it wrongly rolled back local taxes with the statewide vote, also that it misled voters with its ballot title. All of that, he said, was found to be constitutional. He said they hadn't proved enough. The plaintiffs had not proved enough that beyond a reasonable doubt that they were unconstitutional. But he did not rule on two other claims. They have to do with one part of Burien has some bonds out there that it has to pay back with car tab taxes. So he hasn't ruled on whether it's unconstitutional by taking that opportunity away. And also the mandate on Kelley Blue Book being used for the vehicle valuation, because that's a private company. There's right. A constitutional question there. So those two things he didn't rule on. And he didn't rule on it essentially because the court process had been kind of rushed. And the defendants didn't have time to get discovery going on that, so they need more information. He's going to give them that time to get more information so they can have a response to those claims, and then they'll play that out in court, and we'll see how it goes. But everything else, he said, was unconstitutional, and he explained it really, there's a big burden on the challenger to prove beyond right. a reasonable doubt that constitutionality, and they just didn't
need
it.
So who is actually challenging the law? So Burien is among the parties challenging.
We've got Seattle, King County. There are several various transit agencies. Garfield County has signed on to that, and a few others. It's a whole coalition of transit
right.
agencies.
And just to make it clear, the state attorney general is defending the initiative, right?
Yeah, that is his job, to defend state initiative. But, you know, he and Tim Iman have been fighting throughout this with their own legal issues. So I talked with the AG yesterday, and he said he was pleased with this ruling, and he pointed out that the judge's ruling came after a recent court hearing where Tim Iman didn't get up and make a scene in court, and that this one went in their favor, but that at the prior one, when Tim Iman did make a scene, it didn't go their way.
Well, Iman does not believe the attorney general really wants to defend Initiative 976.
No, I don't think he does it, but it is his responsibility, and there was a whole challenge.
And it worked. I mean, Iman got a favorable ruling. So what's the next step for this then?
The next step is going to be this discovery period. So they're going to have to get the whatever they need to provide a defense. That's Iman and his lawyers, a response essentially to those two remaining issues that are out there on the Burien and the Kelley Blue Book. And then they'll hear that in court or file briefs in that in court, and then the judge will rule on that. And that will be the end of it as far as King County Superior Court goes, but you're just about guaranteed an appeal here. First of all, most people believe that this is going to eventually end up before the state Supreme Court, but it would have to go through the appeals process first. Mayor Jenny Durkin yesterday told me that she was disappointed and disagreed with this ruling and that there would likely be a repeal. City Attorney Pete Holmes' office essentially saying the same thing. They were going over the ruling when I talked to them yesterday. So we'll see what happens. They'll have to get through that discovery process first, it sounds like, though.
Okay, so since I-976 is constitutional, when do we get our money back?
Yeah, so that's the other big important part. Hold on. Everything still remains in place as far as that preliminary injunction, which means you do not yet get to pay $30 for your car tabs. Another wrinkle in this, by the way, remember the other case, the lawsuit that was filed over a couple of years ago by several taxpayers against ST3? The $54 million.
Yes.
Right? So this was a challenge to whether or not the bill that the legislature passed allowing Sound Transit to send that $54 billion light rail expansion to the voters was constitutional. It's a very technical challenge, but it went all the way to the state Supreme Court. Those arguments were last year. This morning, in a few hours, we expect a ruling from the state Supreme Court in that case, which is just going to add to more car tab confusion. Joel Ard is the attorney for the taxpayers in that case, and he warned state lawmakers last week that the huge hole in the Sound Transit budget is going to be there regardless of what happens with I-976 if this court ruling goes his way.
I have proposed a resolution to allow Sound Transit to continue collecting that MVET. An adverse decision that could come as soon as 9 a.m. Thursday could strike down that entire statute and close the door on this option. Nothing will resurrect the statute. You will have to pass a new tax authorization. Sound Transit will have to get new voter approval for new taxes to fill an up to $18 billion hole in their budget.
So in plain English, what that means is if the state Supreme Court rules in favor of these taxpayers, it blows ST3 out of the water.
Okay. So we have, this is interesting to me because you have two public votes here that are being challenged.
Yes.
In this case, the I-976 was a public vote to cut the tabs, but then previous to that, we had a public vote to build Sound Transit. So if the voters, if the idea is we err on the side of what the voters say, then both 976 and Sound Transit would have to stand in some way.
Right. And so a couple of things. One, that's the reason that in this entire scenario, somewhere voters are going to lose. Either the voters who voted for ST3 are going to lose or the voters who voted for I-976 are going to lose. Someone is going to feel like their vote didn't matter. As far as this legal challenge to the ST3 case, this is on a very technical issue about the fact that they didn't spell out the valuation system, the depreciation schedule they were going to use. And they only refer to the RCW, which is unconstitutional under our state constitution. That's the legal challenge to it. The effect, though, would be that ST3 is not in effect because that was unconstitutional.
So I guess all those facilities just sort of sit there as a memorial to a group of voters which is at war with itself.
Something to that effect. Something to that effect.
Well, you know, that's what happened with the freeways to nowhere. For years, we had the ramps in the Arboretum and the ramps down at the junction of I-90, which just stood there because people decided, well, we don't want freeways after all.
You can't get people to agree on. There are people who want this light rail so passionately and they want to pay these car tab fees. Yeah. There are those who can't afford it and don't want it. And somebody's going to have to lose. Bottom line here, though, a lot of confusion. We're still anticipating a couple of these court rulings. None of this is going to likely be resolved until the I-976 challenge goes to the state Supreme Court.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
It's being called the intelligence coup of the century. This is Seattle's Morning News, and in the Washington Post is the story of a CIA operation involving the outright purchase of an encryption company, which then sold encryption software to other countries with a little extra added feature that the CIA could read the encrypted material. Greg Miller wrote the story for the Washington Post, and I think it's important to point out that you are not betraying a secret here. This system was closed down, in 2018?
Yeah. Its assets were sold off, and the operation kind of finally came to an end around that time.
But this began as a company which manufactured these old mechanical encryption boxes, which you can sometimes see in war museums, turned to electronics, and the CIA sort of insinuated itself into the ownership of the company and was able to get other countries to buy these machines, which were really betraying their secrets. Now, this was not just against our adversaries, but also involved our allies. And how do they feel about this now that this story is out?
I mean, there has been a huge international reaction to this story. The Swiss government, for example, this company was based in Switzerland, has announced that it is opening an investigation into this, which is a little rich because I think the documents make pretty clear that the Swiss government knew about this operation from the very beginning and is only now claiming to be disturbed by it and wanting to investigate. But it reaches almost every part of the globe. I mean, one of the most astonishing aspects of this operation was its reach. More than 120 countries bought devices from a company that they trusted to help them keep their communication secret without knowing that that company was secretly owned by the CIA and that all of the devices that they were buying were secretly rigged to allow the United States to read all of their secrets.
You got to admit, though, it is a genius idea. And the CIA, I mean, they're in the business of collecting intelligence, so what would you expect them to do?
And the CIA people who are quoted in the documents that we have see it that way, absolutely. They describe this as an utter triumph in espionage.
I guess the thing that worried me most about this was they were actually making money on this, and they got to keep the money they made selling the software?
Yeah, so they're not only stealing these countries' secrets, but taking their money in the process, right? They are charging these countries, these governments, these foreign governments money for the privilege of having all of their secrets laid bare. That's one of the more audacious CIA operations in agency history as a result.
But it also skirts the congressional appropriation process. And it also smacks of what Iran's Revolutionary Guard does. They have their own captive businesses, too, where they just make money off book and use it to run any operation they want.
Yeah, so, I mean, this documents describe the CIA using this cash to invest in other operations and other programs. They ended up buying a couple other companies in Europe with some of the proceeds from this operation. So they're sort of building out their own classified portfolio of investments here. I mean, I should emphasize that it's this relatively small change in the grand scheme of things, because we're talking about tens of millions of dollars here for agencies whose budgets are deep into the billions. So this was a rounding error in their annual budget, but nevertheless, you know, a money-making enterprise.
So are any operations like this still going on now, do you think?
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that these documents in our story raise that question. I think that there are echoes of this all over the place. I mean, not just for U.S. companies, but foreign companies. There, at the moment, there's deep controversy surrounding this Chinese company, Chinese telecommunications giant Huawei, which is trying to create 5G networks in most of Europe and around the Western world. And the United States has deep suspicions that Huawei is being secret, its equipment is secretly compromised by the Chinese government. I mean, I don't really doubt that we will look back on this moment someday, perhaps with the benefit of new histories, and understand that, you know, many companies or some companies that we trust and regard as secure are in fact collaborating with intelligence services.
Well, that's the thing. There's no way to know. If it was tough to figure out back in the day when they were using boxes with gears, it's even more difficult to know now, where everything is on a screen in the form of perishable pixels. Let me ask you this. As somebody who covered this story, does it freak you out, or is this just the world we live in?
It doesn't freak me out in the sense that as a reporter, I take great care with my communications, especially when I'm dealing with sources, to make sure that they're protected and they're not exposed. And then a lot of times that means that the only really secure way to go about doing that is to meet somebody in person. It's hard to trust any communications system at all completely. But I do think that this whole history raises pretty important and disturbing questions of morals and ethics. I mean, part of our story is about how many, not just how many countries were deceived, but how many crypto employees, hundreds of employees working for a company that had no idea their real owner was the CIA. They're going around the world selling these devices. They don't know that they're rigged. I mean, their safety is in jeopardy, and they are completely unwitting. And that raises troubling questions about it. How ethical is it to do that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the reason the CIA felt okay with disclosing this is that private encryption schemes have taken over for the stuff that they were doing. So Apple and Microsoft, I mean, all of us now have access to this encryption, and to keep our communications private, or at least we think they're private. How do we know? We don't know. We have most of us have no clue whether encryption really works, whether there's somebody sitting in a basement somewhere reading everything we do.
Yes, I mean, that's true. There's always reason to be skeptical. I would note, I mean, you said a moment ago that the CIA thought that it was okay to release this. In fact, the CIA did not think it was okay to release this.
This is not
material that has been declassified. We obtained these documents through sourcing that we're not really able to disclose, but nothing has been publicly released about this operation. And in fact, in our story, we make clear that the CIA and the NSA declined to comment on these allegations.
Oh, I see. Well, then at least that shows that they were unable to hack your security and had no idea what you were up to, right?
I suppose, yeah.
Greg Miller is with the Washington Post. Their story is called The Intelligence Coup of the Century. Greg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now. It's sponsored by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. 3 years ago, we met an 82-year-old widow, Dan Peterson, who was lifted out of his grief by the most unexpected of ways, a hug from a stranger who was just 4 years old. Well, the sad update this morning is that Dan has passed away now. But I think after revisiting their story, you'll come to learn that while we may be sad to say goodbye to Dan, he certainly wasn't sad in the end. Here's CBS's Steve Hartman with the original story.
82-year-old Dan Peterson says after Mary died, he fell into a deep depression. Spent days just staring out at the squirrels.
What were you living for?
I was trying to figure that out, frankly.
You had no purpose?
No.
Were you just waiting to die?
Yeah.
For 6 months, it was just that bad.
And then one day you go to a grocery store.
It all changed inside this Publix.
Dan was nearing the end of the canned vegetable aisle. He hates grocery shopping, and by all accounts, the expression on his face confirmed his aggravation. But that's when this unapproachable man was approached by a 4-year-old girl named Nora Wood.
In the security footage, you can see Nora randomly reaching out to him. Her mom, Tara, says it was quite embarrassing.
She stood up and said, "Hi, old person, it's my birthday today."
Old person?
Old person.
Hi, old person.
She says this to this cranky old man?
Yeah.
And then had the audacity to demand a hug.
I said, "A hug?" I said, "Absolutely."
Nora got her hug and then asked her mom to take a picture of her with her new friend.
She zeroed in on him like a missile. And she didn't want anything from him. She just wanted to make him feel loved and give him a hug. And his little lip quivered and he was teared up and it was just sweet.
And I said, "You don't know. This is the first time for quite a while that I've been as happy."
And that happiness continued. Steve Hartman writes on Twitter that Nora and her mom continue to visit Dan every week ever since that first hug back in November of 2016, and that Dan got his last hug from Nora the day before he passed away.
Wow, what a story.
If I say any more words, I'm going to cry.
I'm
Dave.
Looking at you.
I tried to hold it together, but then you looked at me, and now I'm going to cry.
Well, now you looked at me. And I recognize that music. Let's go to Peoria, Arizona, where the forecast calls for sunshine, a high of 67, and Mariners baseball with veteran Mariners reporter Shannon Dreyer, who joins us live.
It's great to have you too, Shannon. I'm excited about the news about Taijuan Walker coming back, but I also want to ask, along that same vein, is this just sort of a Hail Mary attempt to get the pitching staff in order? Don't we have any prospects coming up after King Felix left?
Yeah, you know, this year is an interesting year for the Mariners in that they have already gone out and said that it's going to be all about seeing these young players and prospects. And when you see young players and prospects in large groups, you're not going to have as many wins as when you surround them with veterans. So the core of this team is actually going to be a lot of younger players. And there are some young starters. Justice Sheffield is a guy that they got in the James Paxton trade. And it's time for him to take that next step forward and become a consistent big leaguer out on the hill. He's had a couple of taste of the big leagues. And this year, he will come out of spring training with a spot in the rotation, and we'll see what he's got. Justin Dunn is another one that's coming up. And then the three pitchers that they drafted last year are the ones that I think that you're going to see some of the bigger performances from. They're still a year, maybe 2 years out right now, but pitchers are moving quicker now, particularly the college pitchers. So they're there. They're a little bit further back. And with Taijuan, they need some guys that are going to be able to eat some innings. And Taijuan is coming off an elbow surgery, so it's going to be a little while before he can do that. But he will eventually be able to do that. And then there's so much upside. I think it was almost a why not? He fits a need that we have. It's just a one-year contract. But if they find something in him, he may be of value to trade later in the season, or the extreme. If he has an absolutely stellar season and proves to be one of the elite, you might look at putting a qualifying offer on him. That's a real long shot. But he adds to the rotation. He will help out. And it's going to be a mix. But I think you're going to see a lot more young than veteran this year.
So it's only a 1 year just to test him out. It's not because he's aging out or injured or anything like that.
Well, he's coming back from injury, and I think a lot of it is he would have been a free agent anyway. He was under club control. He was DFA'd by his last team. One way or another, he was going to be a free agent at the end of the year unless he signed a multiple-year contract. And so I think from his standpoint, this is a prove-it year for him to go get a bigger contract.
So, Marco Gonzalez, what's his history?
His history, and it's a good one. He was a first-round pick out of Gonzaga with the St. Louis Cardinals organization, who, of course, is known for their pitching, came up very quickly, actually pitched out of the bullpen in relief in the playoffs for the Cardinals just a year after he was drafted, was traded, actually the next year, came up with a Tommy John injury, was out for almost two seasons, was traded to the Mariners. They took their time getting him back, and lo and behold, you look at him now. They've gotten to know him the last 3 years. It's almost been a three-year audition while he's been under club control, and he's proven to be everything that they want on and off the field, a definite leader type, a definite guy that's going to put his arms around the pitching staff and say, follow me. Doesn't matter that he's just 27. That's just kind of who he is. As always, despite having that injury and being out for some time and being the young guy, has always still had that. I'm a first rounder. I was the number one pitcher at Gonzaga. I was the number one pitcher at every level that I've ever been. Always had that in him. And he's a guy so many in baseball say, well, yeah, I don't really want to lead, or I'll lead by example. He's a guy that wants to lead. And the Mariners rewarded that with the contract along with the performance. He was just one of 15 pitchers in baseball last year to put up 200 innings or more. And there's a lot of value in that.
Okay, so it sounds like, I mean, for the fans, can they go to the stadium knowing that the pitching problems are, if not completely repaired, showing progress?
Well, it's about progress. I mean, you go to the stadium and you know that you're probably going to get consistency out of Marco Gonzalez, and then you're going to wonder what you're going to see from Taiwan Walker. As he gets healthy, is there some of that that made him a potential number one just a few years ago before the injury? You say Kikuchi's an interesting one. He had a miserable first season. He's made it, or attempted to make, a lot of adjustments in the offseason. He's with the Mariners for a minimum of three more years, and they got him to be more of a two, more of a three guy. You know, does he take a step forward? And then after that, you're watching that staff to see who are the future guys, who are the future mainstays of this rotation. And it's going to be a process, and I think at times it's not going to be pretty, but if some of these guys pop, it could be exciting. And then sometime this year, possibly as soon as June, you're going to see Logan Gilbert, who was their number one pick 2 years ago, in that rotation. And he's a guy that's got bigger stuff, and that's when the imagination could probably start getting going a little bit more.
Shannon, if we're heading into more rain today, could you please just indulge us and describe to us what it's like down at spring training in Arizona? What's the vibe right now?
I'll tell you, it was 44 degrees when I left the house today, but there is bright sun. You cannot forget the sunglasses. You're in big trouble if you do. It's definitely drier here. It's good to get out of the, 2 feet of rain that we've had in the last, 2 weeks. It's beautiful. You get down here, you come here every year, you know, sights are different, sounds are different, the birds sound different, you hear baseball, you see baseball, and it's just great to be out in the sun. You know, it's a long day in spring training, but nobody's complaining because of the conditions.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. Well, continue to tough it out, all right? We're, you know, be safe, have the sunglasses at the at standby, and we'll check in with you later. Thank you, Shannon.
All right, good to talk to you guys.
This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. We have some news out of the Defense Department this morning. Defense Secretary Mark Esper made this announcement.
The United States and the Taliban have negotiated a proposal for a 7-day reduction in violence. I'm here today consulting with allies about this proposal, and we've had a series of productive bilateral and collective meetings about the path forward.
Now, that sounds positive, although 7 days doesn't sound like a lot. So let's get some perspective from former acting CIA Director Michael Morrell, who is the host of Intelligence Matters, which airs Saturdays here on Cairo Radio. Mike, what does this mean? Does this represent a breakthrough or not?
So, Dave, I don't think so. You noted the length of the reduction in violence of only a week. And I think the other important thing is this is not a ceasefire, right? This is not an end to hostilities for a week. This is a reduction in violence. And nobody on the U.S. side or the Afghan side or the Taliban side have defined what a reduction means. You know, is it 80% reduction? Is it 20% reduction? So there's not a lot of specificity here. There's not a significant length. So I'm not sure how significant this is at this moment.
So what are we still doing there, Mike? I know that it's a, pretty facile question to be asking, but the president has certainly asked it, and I know that a lot of people are wondering whether there's anything more we can do. Afghanistan is not the U.S. We're not going to make it into a democracy, so what are we doing there?
So that is a very good question, and what we're doing there is we're preventing the Taliban from taking over the Afghan government again, because we believe that in that case, if that happens, they will, despite what they say, invite al-Qaeda to have safe haven there. And if al-Qaeda has safe haven there, they'll be able to, in short order, rebuild their capabilities and possibly pose a threat again to the homeland. So that's what we're doing there. I certainly understand, and most national security people understand, that without public support, we can't stay there, and we don't have that public support. And the president realizes that. President Obama realized that. And I think that's what's driving the president to think about withdrawing. So if we do withdraw, it's not the end of the world, as long as we do two things. As long as we figure out a way to continue to collect intelligence on al-Qaeda, if the Taliban takes over again, and that we figure out a way to be able to conduct military operations against al-Qaeda should they begin to plan operations against us and build their capabilities to do that. So if we're forced to leave and we're able to do those two things, then we'll be okay. And so I hope the administration, while they're having these conversations that are all designed to give us a face-saving way out, right? That's what the peace negotiations are about, mm-hmm. giving us a face-saving way out. And I understand that. I understand that for all the young men and young women who fought there. But at the same time, we really need to be thinking about how are we going to protect ourselves once we leave and the Taliban take over and give safe haven again to al-Qaeda.
Well, I have to assume that we've been there long enough to identify who has an interest in providing information about the Taliban's activities, and that we've set up some sort of network so that even if we leave, there's going to be a pretty healthy flow of intelligence that would give us a heads up, right? If they suddenly start opening training camps, and then we can bomb them, I guess.
Well, we're there now, right? We're there. The United States government is there in large numbers in a number of facilities across the country. So you can imagine the advantage that gives you both from an intelligence perspective and a military perspective. If you have to leave all of those, including if you have to leave the embassy, then collecting intelligence and conducting military operations becomes a much more difficult task. Not impossible, but much more difficult.
Hmm. So we don't have a network of spies there that would be able to, you could sustain without the, of course,
Dave,
you can't tell me, can you?
Dave, there's certain things I can't tell you. I'm sorry.
Okay, sorry. Didn't even mean to bring it up. So forgot to mention that. We'll cut that out of the podcast. All right. I wanted to ask you about this story in the Washington Post about the encryption company, Crypto AG, that the CIA was running and was selling encryption software that had a backdoor. Am I allowed to ask you about that or not?
So you're allowed to ask me. I can't confirm or deny whether the CIA was involved with such a company or created such a company. But I can say this. I think if I were able to tell the American people about the collection systems that the U.S. intelligence community has developed over the years, they would be very proud of their intelligence community.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I must admit, it struck me, you know, if this actually did happen, it certainly was a genius idea. The I guess the only possible qualm is, you know, if you can put in a backdoor in the encryption technology, you know, for our allies, then how many backdoors are there out there? And does anybody really have any privacy when you get right down to it?
Well, when you do, right, when you do create a backdoor, whether you're the U.S. government or you're a company, right, and you create a backdoor in your own software so you'll be able to go in and fix things. Whenever you create a backdoor, you create a vulnerability that somebody else can take advantage of. So that is absolutely a downside to the creation of a backdoor, and it's why Apple refuses, right, to do so for its own software.
Right. Your guest on Saturday's episode of Intelligence Matters is Robert Wirth, who got access to the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, Mohammed bin Zayed. And I know most people don't know who he is, but I find that area of the country. I spent some time in Qatar, which is run by the, I think it's run by the Al Thani family.
Yes.
And what's interesting about it is that it's like a family business. And I talked to a guy who used to be a good friend of the Sheikh there, of the Emir. and said he's a very nice man, but once I wrote a letter, I think it was a letter to the newspaper. I wrote a letter to the newspaper that he didn't like, and suddenly when I went to the airport to try to go on a trip, my passport was blocked. So it's I mean, are those good allies for us, or I mean, can we rely on governments like that?
Yes, we can. The Emiratis and the Qataris are both very good allies of the United States. We have military bases in both countries. We cooperate with them militarily and from an intelligence perspective. We are all focused on the Iranian threat together. So, yes, I consider both of them to be good allies of the United States.
All right. Well, that's reassuring anyway. Well, you did a good job. I tried to break you, but you refused to betray any secrets. So I guess that's what makes you worthy of being a CIA director. Mike Morrell, who is the host of Intelligence Matters. Mike, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Take care, Dave.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Choke points.
Let's go.
And this strikes me as a moral question. Is it okay to counterfeit a traffic jam indication on a popular traffic app for the purpose of protecting your own community from drivers seeking shortcuts? This is something that's come up quite a bit with your drivers.
Yes, and it's something that's been has come up for, you know, several years, really. I mean, we've been talking about traffic apps like Waze or InRex or, you know, Google Maps, things like that, and where they will direct people through areas and they don't really know that they're sending people through neighborhoods or things like that. And we've seen some issues with people who are trying to game the system to try to make those apps think their neighborhood streets are blocked off and are in bad shape. And in fact, in some neighborhoods, people have gotten, you know, locals only signs put up by their city councils. Some cities, I think one on the East Coast, I did a story on, they actually put up you had to have a sticker on your car to drive through certain roads during certain drive times. And if you didn't have one, you could get like a $200 fine. The people are trying to find ways around this. And, you know, we've seen things around here, like we've added neighborhood roundabouts, we've added speed bumps, even some first traffic diverters, which I did a feature on up in the Aurora neighborhood, where people are not allowed to cut through east-west between Aurora and Greenwood and places like that, because they just can't handle the volume or the speed. So I talked to Wade a few years ago, and for people who don't know, what Waze is, a traffic app that basically tells you the fastest way to get where you're going, and in some instances will be like turn here, turn there, you're making like seven turns in the span of like five blocks to save like 3 minutes, but that's what it's doing. And the people have told me there that, you know, there are really too many checks and balances with Waze. They have too many people out there using the system for you to go out there and say, there's an accident, and game the system.
Just simply other drivers who may not even be aware that they're contributing against these reports. If you just drive down the street and you're going 30 miles an hour, obviously there is no accident blocking that road, and obviously the road is open.
That way, a spokesperson told me that it would take an army of people reporting that same problem for this to work. Well, we found out this month that it really doesn't take an army. It takes an army of cell phones and one little red wagon. An artist in Germany by the name of Simon Weckert put 99 cell phones with their GPS enabled in a small wagon, and he started walking down the streets of Berlin. Pretty soon, all of those phones were reporting 1 mile an hour, 2 mile an hour speeds as they were being dragged down the street. And we watch on the videos that he's posted, the Google Maps going from green to orange to red, and it looks like there's a massive traffic jam there, even though the street was virtually empty. So Google told the Washington Post that it does have technology that it can determine the difference between cars or motorcycles, but it doesn't have anything to guard against 99 cell phones in a little red wagon. That technology, by the way, has launched in India, Indonesia, and Egypt, but it's not available worldwide. So this guy figured out how to do it. And, you know, maybe this works, maybe it doesn't in practical purposes. I mean, I'm not sure how many people have 99 cell phones that they can run around and just spend the day walking down their neighborhood street to make things more safer.
It just seems that the software would be wise to that, because they would all have the exact same geometric location. Yeah.
So, but it was interesting. I mean, I put the link up to the story that includes some of the video up at mynorthwest.com that just shows this guy walking down the street.
Who would try the same thing on a local street? I'd be interested to know if it could be repeated.
Well, because I know people in Bellevue that have tried by doing the original way, which is reporting an accident, but then people drive through there and say thumbs down. There's no accident here, and so it gets factored back into the system. So we'll see. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to go tell people that they should go out and try this, but it looks like this might be the way to fool those systems. Well, I don't know.
It's not going to hurt anyone.
Well, if you're walking down the middle of the street, you probably shouldn't be.
You can walk along the side of the street.
But yeah, so I just found it kind of interesting that of all the ways people did it, then it took us this long to figure that all you have to do is put a bunch of the cell phones that people, the ways or these apps think are in their car, in a little bucket and, you know, just drag it around. And it seems like the simplest way to fool this thing seems to be the most effective. You can ring my
bell, ring your bell. It's just one of those pop culture things that seeped into the public consciousness decades ago and never went away. Here's Rachel Bell.
The romantic comedy Sleepless in Seattle came out on June 25th, 1993.
Are you sleeping at night?
He doesn't sleep at all.
How do you know that?
I live here, Dad.
1993 was 27 years ago. But if you were to go to SeaTac Airport today, you will still see the Sleepless in Seattle nightshirt.
You saw her in the airport and then here?
And I tried to talk to her. It was like I knew her or something. It was weird.
You mean like a deja vu thing?
It was a very French deja vu-ish kind of thing. Oui.
You've seen this shirt. It's got prime real estate at Hudson stores. Right in front, before you even walk into the store to get your magazine and your gum. It's a long, light gray t-shirt, one size fits most, with rolled up baby pink sleeves and Sleepless in Seattle written across the front in cursive. And it is oh so 1993. And every time I go to the airport and pass by this shirt, which is every time I go to the airport, I chuckle to myself. Who is still buying this shirt? Well, the answer is a lot of people.
We sell between 8,000 to 9,000 pieces per year, and it's been a steady sale. There's a strong following with the Sleepless in Seattle shirts. When people come through, they must have it.
8,000 to 9,000 a year. That's Hudson Assistant General Manager Anna Kovalik. So who is buying this nightshirt?
We were at SeaTac, and I realized that I had left my pajamas at home.
That's Renton's Kim Untai.
I saw the Sleepless in Seattle shirt, and it made me giggle because I'm frequently sleepless. It was a perfect fit for me and very comfortable, and it makes a lot of people laugh and smile when they see it. And I wore it out. I wore it so much.
So Kim got a second one.
My daughter knew that I had to get rid of it because it was full of holes. And for my birthday last year, on her way home from Vegas, she saw it in the airport and said, I have to get this for my mother for her birthday. I have a new one and I am so happy.
Then there's Seattle's Marty Austin.
I've always seen them in the airport and always laugh at them. And my mother-in-law, who lives in Florida, she just absolutely loves the movie Sleepless in Seattle. And every time she's here, you know, we'll be driving around and, oh, look, is that the house? Oh, I think I saw that in the movie. And so one day she comes to visit and she says, oh, I got a present for you. And it's in the airport bag. And it's the Sleepless in Seattle nightshirt. I'm like, you bought me a souvenir from the town I live in. And I just kind of laughed. Then she laughed and then, you know, took the gift and just never wore it.
Sammamish's Christopher Jensen moved to Seattle in 1996.
Back when I was starting to interview for, let's call it, a large aerospace manufacturer in the area.
He was flying back home to Jersey and wanted to get his family gifts that defied the stereotypes of the region.
It was made up of just trees, coffee bars, and Microsoft and Boeing. So I guess it was the movie that changed everybody's perceptions of the area beyond singles at that point. When I was searching for something to bring home that was representative of the area to teach them, this shirt came out of nowhere. This pink and gray nightshirt that I thought would be perfect for my mom and my sister. So I grabbed a couple.
Did they like the gift?
My mother still has it. And I wonder if it's getting a little worn out. I kind of now after this wonder if I'll refresh her with a new one.
Marty is confused that the airport is still selling this t-shirt. In the past 27 years, hasn't another piece of Seattle pop culture trumped Sleepless in Seattle? But Christopher, he finds it comforting.
You know, after 27 years, you'd think this thing would be culturally less relevant. And I always smile, and you kind of made me wonder why. And I think it's because we all like having that bedrock of something that doesn't change. in our world of continuous change, especially in this area, to see something that doesn't. I kind of wonder how long it's going to stay there.
In case you're wondering, Hudson's top-selling item is a bronze Space Needle figurine.
Like a wink and a smile.
I was wondering why you go to the airport and you still see the Sleepless in Seattle shirt, and there's a reason. Because people buy them.
I've never even seen it.
Yeah.
It and I go into Hudson's every time. I've been flown three times in the last 30 days.
You're now...
And I've never seen it.
You're shirt blind.
Yeah, apparently. Maybe I just go in to get my Diet Coke and chewing gum and a bag of beef jerky.
You can get that anywhere.
It. Yeah.
Sleepless in Seattle shirt's only in Seattle.
I'll just try to take that through TSA. But yeah, yeah. I don't... Yeah, I've never seen it.
Yeah, it's there. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.